Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is paying your taxes an act of patriotism? And how can we know whether the way each of us is required to contribute is really good for us as U.S. citizens? My guest today is convinced current law favors corporations and the very wealthiest individuals, think million-dollar annual incomes and up, while a dangerous lack of financial regulation puts everybody else's interests at risk. David K. Johnston is a columnist for the trade journal Tax Notes and former tax reporter for the New York Times. He is also a Pulitzer Prize winner. He writes about the current state of affairs and potential solutions in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. The article is called Fiscal Therapy. David, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris.
We should start the way you start your article. You're occasionally called on to lecture about the tax system to students, and when you do, you ask them to identify the purpose of the United States. What is it that they tell you?
Well, that our purpose is to get rich. And that shouldn't surprise us. The median age of Americans is 37, so half of all Americans were no more than 11 years old when Ronald Reagan took office and began changing our relationship to our government. And what did Mr. Reagan and those who followed, and politicians all across the country and now cable TV and everything else, constantly tell us? That government is about our wealth. And yet, the purpose of our country was written down for us. It's in 52 words that many students, I'm finding, even at the best colleges, have never read or don't recall reading. And you can reduce it to six simple principles. The preamble to our Constitution talks about a more perfect union, society, establishing justice, domestic tranquility or peace, common defense, security, promoting the commonwealth, and freedom. Getting rich isn't on that list.
We know that a lot of Americans today are deeply in debt, and the federal government is so much in debt that the interest alone now takes us months to pay every year.
Yes, in fact, interest on the national debt, apart from the bailout, this year will equal all of the income taxes that all Americans will have withheld from their pay and other forms of income in January, February, March, April, and a portion of May. Probably more than half of May.
So this sounds like a lot like a person who is paying on his or her credit card and can't really get much above the minimum balance.
That's exactly right. Well, go back to 1980. What did Mr. Reagan make three specific promises to the American people? He said, I'm going to get government off your back. Government, he famously said, is the problem. By reducing regulation and unleashing business so that we'll have prosperity. Secondly, he said, I'm going to cut your taxes. And third, he said, I'm going to balance the budget. Well, the federal debt when Mr. Reagan took office in today's dollars was less than $2.5 trillion. It's now essentially $11 trillion without counting big parts of the bailout we can't price yet because we don't know if they're going to work or not. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans in 2006 was the same as it was in 1980. It's undoubtedly lower now, though we won't have the data for a little while. And it is certainly lower than in 1973, which was the peak year for the bottom 90% of Americans. Meanwhile, at the top, just 1,000 Americans make one more than a penny out of every dollar of income in the United States. Back in 1980, it took the top about 27,000 Americans to make a penny of total income. Now we're down to just 1,000.
And those 1,000 are paying a disproportionately tiny share, considering how much they earn, overall income tax.
They pay an enormous share of the total income tax because they have such huge incomes. But as a share of their income, they pay a smaller share than people who make $50,000 to $75,000 in total federal taxes. And they pay less than people who make $500,000 a year just in income taxes. And by the way, the average income of the top 1,000 Americans is about $200 million for a year. At least five of them that we know of had incomes of more than $1 billion for a year.
Now, the justification, of course, for that inequity is very often this idea of trickle-down economics. Can you talk about that and how it actually plays out in the real economy?
Well, trickle-down, it's important to remember, was not something Mr. Reagan promoted. It was what his critics used to describe his economics. The theory, though, essentially was that if those at the top were able to keep more of their income, they would invest it, which would result in more jobs, which would result in general prosperity, hence the idea of trickle-down. In fact, what we know happened now, because we have 28 years of experience, is that a lot of this money was invested in unproductive assets. The price of masters and other paintings went through the roof during this period. Lots of people bought numerous homes, which are unproductive assets. And that business investment was in good measure directed overseas, so that for blue-collar America, millions of people have seen jobs that paid them a working-class or middle-class wage go to China, where you can hire factory workers for a dollar or so a day, and the communist thugs in Beijing will make sure at the point of a gun that no independent union is organized.
So in other words, the argument that taking a greater share of personal income from the very top echelon or of corporate income as income tax doesn't automatically mean that Americans at the lower echelons will be directly affected right away.
That's right. And furthermore, when you go back and look at periods of economic growth in America, our greatest economic growth occurred when the top marginal tax rate was 91%. I'm not arguing for a 91% tax rate, but as we have cut taxes, the economy has gone downhill. When we raised taxes on those at the top in 1993 under Clinton, the economy grew for several years. And one of the things we have to, I think, start talking about is whether taxes prompt you to work more so that you'll have what you want after taxes. There's a significant amount of research showing that with the estate tax, if you, assuming every dollar were subject to the estate tax, and it's not, the exemption now is $3.5 million for one person, $7 million for a couple, and that's without doing any tax planning at all.
We should be so lucky as to have to pay that kind of tax.
That's right. Very, very few people have. But let's assume the estate tax started at $1 of wealth when you died, and the government took half. People who wanted to leave $1 million to their children or grandchildren would therefore save $2 million to get the $1 million net. If you take the tax away, they only have to save $1 million to leave $1 million. And so there's evidence where people have been interviewed about their behavior and their patterns, and I have interviewed hundreds and hundreds of estate lawyers, all of whom say people tend to pick a target and save to it and include the tax in it. Now, that's not to argue that the estate tax is the way it is or the way it should be. It's only to talk about the principles of behavior.
David K. Johnston is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer about taxes. Currently, he's a columnist for the trade journal Tax Notes, and he's got a piece called Fiscal Therapy in the January-February 2009 issue of Mother Jones magazine. So one of the first changes that you would like to make has to do with the way companies report their finances to shareholders as compared with the IRS. I was amazed to read, perhaps I'm naive, that there are very often two sets of books.
There are always two sets of books. The law requires that. Companies that report in their financial statements to shareholders that they pay hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in taxes, when you dig into the fine print of their financial statements, which is one of the things I do for a living, you often find that they pay little or nothing and in many cases actually get money back from the government. The reason is that they are required to keep two sets of books. This is not some mafia joke. One set of books is for shareholders and the other set of books is for tax rules. And tax accounting is vastly more favorable than book accounting. That's what shareholders see. Now, the British decided some time ago to essentially get rid of this system and say whatever you report to your shareholders is what you will pay taxes on, which, of course, aligned the interests of the government with shareholders who want the biggest possible number. That works for publicly traded companies, and I suggest that we should simply move toward that system. In theory, both systems are supposed to produce over the life of a company the same amount of revenue, just at different times that it gets paid. They're called timing differences. But in reality, we know that that doesn't happen, that companies, when they go into decline, stop paying taxes. They're allowed to reach back into their books and use these losses, and they underpay. Secondly, by having two sets of books, we're allowing companies to take a lot of their profits offshore. Back in 1990, about $1 in 10 of U.S. corporate profits was taken in a tax haven like the Cayman Islands. Today, it's about 25%. And so huge amounts of corporate profits are going untaxed because of the use of these parasitical little operations like the Cayman Islands that provide no services and make their money by helping individuals and companies cheat, lie, and deny, hide money from governments, hide money from spouses, hide money from law enforcement. And by the way, the techniques that these places like the Cayman Islands enable are the very same, provide the very same benefits to people like Hezbollah and Osama bin Laden.
You write, and only half jokingly, it seems, that we ought to consider threatening the Caymans with invasion.
Absolutely. And it's somewhat jokingly because I don't think it's going to happen, but we do not have enough revenue right now to sustain the federal government. It is going deeply into debt. And Edmund Burke, the founder of modern conservatism, in his famous 1793 letter wrote, "The revenue of the state is the state." Well, there are hundreds of billions, probably trillions of dollars of untaxed dollars offshore in the Cayman Islands and the other 25 or so tax havens around the world. And they don't provide any useful function. So I suggest Congress should pass a law requiring them to fully cooperate. What they do now is if the IRS identifies a specific tax cheat and asks for information about that person by name, rank, and serial number, they get it. We should tell them we're not going to tolerate this anymore. We should cut them off from the banking system, which we've done very successfully, you know, to Cuba for 50 years now. We should ratchet it up to then say that if Americans go there as tourists, they will be prosecuted unless they have the government's permission. That's what we also do with Cuba. And ultimately, if they don't cooperate and stop helping, and it's, by the way, it's one law firm in one building that does most of this work, that we should send in a handful of Marines, because there's no military in the Cayman Islands. There's 300 British-trained cops and several thousand forensic accountants, auditors, and computer technicians to get the records. And then we should go after the cheats by telling them, if you admit your wrongdoing to the government within 30 days and arrange within 6 months to pay everything you owe, that includes the penalties and the interest, your name will never be public, and you can go on with your life. If you don't, the federal government's position is every single one of you will be prosecuted criminally, and jail time will be sought, and we will go after you civilly, and we will strip you of every asset you have for the crimes that you have committed against the people of the United States.
Any risk, if we did that, that we would lose some companies altogether, that they would simply pull out of the United States completely if they couldn't put their money offshore?
The biggest market in the world, companies are going to walk away. Well, maybe they will, but since this is the biggest market in the world, I think other companies will come along. That's part of the dynamic of capitalism. Companies rise up from nowhere, and companies fail. And we right now live in an era of corporate socialism in which our government, particularly under the Bush administration, which had promised us market principles and fiscal restraint, has adopted a no big company can fail strategy.
Back in just a minute with Pulitzer Prize winner David K. Johnston. We're talking about his article Fiscal Therapy, which appears in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning tax writer David K. Johnston. He has an article in the current issue of Mother Jones. It's called Fiscal Therapy. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Another thing you would look at, David, is ending tax deferrals, which have allowed some very wealthy people to put off paying taxes, in some cases until their deaths. How does that work?
Well, you and I are allowed to save a limited amount of money each year without paying taxes on it for our old age. If you work for an employer, you can save $16,000. If you're my age, over 50, you can save an extra $5,000 or $6,000. If you don't have an employer with a plan, the most you can save is $5,000. But if you are under a little-known law, if you are a corporate executive, an athlete, a movie star, someone with a very huge income, you were allowed to defer unlimited amounts of money. Way back in 1996, we revealed how top executives in American companies had built incredible fortunes. The head of Coca-Cola had put away $1 billion without paying any taxes, an amount that was so big it turned out a number of members of the Coke board didn't know about it until they read it. Now, America has two income tax systems, separate and unequal. One is for wage earners. The government takes the money out of your check before you're paid. It knows exactly how much you made because your employer reports it. It also knows how much you paid in mortgage interest, how much you got in dividends from any stocks you own, how much you got in interest from your savings. But business owners, landlords, and investors, and I've been all three of those, by the way, a business owner, landlord, and investor, are trusted by Congress to report their income in full, with very little verification. Unless you're audited, basically there's no checking. And you're allowed to do these massive deferrals. So I have held in my hands documents from hedge fund managers who are less than 40 years old, who have multi-billion dollar fortunes offshore on which they've never paid taxes. You can arrange at the point that you're going to die, assuming the government even has a record and can find you, to convert this into life insurance and through a trust have it paid out to your heirs, and the government will never collect taxes on the money. I suggest that we should end these deferrals and force all these people to pay up. If you want to loan money to your company, you should be absolutely free to do that, but you should do it after you pay taxes on your income. You pay your taxes first, then you loan out the money, and we should limit all deferrals to those amounts set in law. And by the way, business owners already have a right tax deferred to save. I think the max this year is $46,000. Not an inconsequential amount of money to most Americans.
And how much money are we talking here if we limited everybody in the country to the same deferrals that you and I get, 16 grand a year or whatever it is? How much money would we have?
Well, Chris, that's one of the things we don't know because, well, our government collects precise numbers on what it spends on school lunches for poor children or benefits to widows. It doesn't keep track of any of this. In my book, Free Lunch, I reveal all sorts of these devices and taxes that Americans pay that never go to the government but are given to large corporations and wealthy individuals through all sorts of legal devices that are hardly known about. And it's not what politicians talk about. Many of them, I don't think, understand what they're doing when they adopt these things. But the government doesn't keep records. I'm confident, however, from the limited material we have, some public reports on total numbers by the Cayman Islands and Bermuda governments and some other records, that we would raise many hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe $1 trillion in taxes, if we ended all these deferral and offshore account games right now.
David K. Johnston is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey, great conversation. I wanted to bring up one of many conversations that I have had recently, the most recent and particular one being during the election last year. I was talking to a friend of mine who happens to work at a waiter here in Dallas, as a waiter, rather, and we were talking about the election, and this person was vehemently opposed to voting for Barack Obama. And I said, well, what's the deal? And they said, well, I don't want my taxes to be raised. And I said, okay, I understand. So we talked about it for a little bit, and I said, well, you realize that you probably make somewhere around the range of like 25 grand, because I happen to have worked for this restaurant years back. You realize that under the plan that he has laid out for everyone, that your taxes actually won't be increased. As it stands now, it probably will mean that you pay a little less taxes. Although, after listening to this conversation, I'm not sure if that's true or not. Anyway, this person said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And I said, well, why are you so emotionally attached to this idea of not being, when it does not affect you at all in the negative? And the person said, and like I said, I've heard this on several occasions, because one day it will. One day I will be rich enough, and I don't want my taxes to be raised once I get my money. I think it's a fascinating, kind of an emotional attachment that people have to this, and I wonder if the guest might have some comments about it.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
Well, I think Tim's raised an incredibly revealing point about political culture and how Reaganism has shaped America. If you go to YouTube and look up the 6-minute ABC video of Obama talking to Joe Wurlsbacher, Joe the plumber, right. You will see this very thing played out, and Obama says to him, if my tax plan had been in effect, where I'm giving a tax cut to the middle class, you would have been able to save money because you'd have more money in your pocket so that you could start your own business. And that's a fundamental thing we seem to have failed to recognize. You know that the percentage of Americans who have any savings account and who earned any interest at all that was taxable has fallen below half. Now, you go back 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the vast majority of Americans had savings. We have gotten rid of savings. People are in debt up to their eyeballs because of the changes in the economy, and the tax system is fundamental to this. What's happened and what I've been documenting, and everything I write about comes from the official government record, all the things I wrote during the Clinton and Bush administrations in the New York Times, they never disputed the facts. In some cases, the Bush administration endorsed facts that I reported. What the income tax system has been turned into is a massive redistribution program up. It's not trickle down. It's Niagara up. And our tax system is taking from those with less, taking from the poor, the middle class, and the affluent to give to the super rich. And the data on this is so overwhelming, but it is not part of our political narrative. If you turn on the radio or the TV and you listen to the commentators from Washington, without attribution, they will give you the same narrative on NPR that you'll hear on Fox. Republicans are trying to build a stronger economy and make us all wealthier by cutting taxes, and the Democrats want to raise taxes on the rich, which will destroy our economy, with no context, no examination of the historic record or of what's happened in other countries where higher taxes actually create, for the vast majority of people, a wealthier society.
Do you think, David, that our lack of savings is mostly attributable to economic hardship, or is it really a cultural shift to where people use their consumer credit in lieu of savings? In other words, the safety net is your credit card, not your savings account.
Right. Well, I think it's both. I think that this is not a simple issue. First of all, we've introduced easy access to credit, unbelievably easy access to credit. And we know now from a growing amount of research into behavior and economics that lots of people will respond to the siren call of easy money and do not understand the economic consequences of it. Secondly, the tax system used to reward savers, and it now no longer does. Up until 1980, a married couple could collect, I think it was $400, of dividends and interest without having to pay taxes on it. And one of the things I've recommended is we go back to this system and we set it at a level adjusted for inflation, so it's roughly $1,000 or $500 for an individual. That would encourage people to save at current interest rates about 50 times that much money, and they wouldn't pay any interest on it. And, when people don't have savings, and then they may not have access to their credit. Most credit card agreements are written in such a way the bank can just cut you off with no notice on your credit line. People then end up turning to government-supported services for help, even if it's a charity. Many of those charities are, in one way or another, largely or partly underwritten by the government, and certainly through donations are underwritten by the government because those are tax-deductible. We need to go to a society of prudence that encourages people to save and to get them to adopt the only real financial rule anybody needs to do reasonably well in life. Spend less than you make.
David K. Johnston is here. We are talking about some of the ideas outlined in his article, Fiscal Therapy, which appears in the January-February 2009 issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Let's speak next to Tom in Arlington. Hello, Tom.
How about a flat rate tax as a way of simplifying the tax code and making the rich pay their fair share? You're saying that our current system is already unfair for the lower and middle class, that the rich and the rich corporations aren't paying. So if we taxed wages and capital gains equally at a flat rate for everyone, including corporations, with some minimum amount remaining exempt for the truly poor, wouldn't that be more fair and understandable for the majority of Americans?
Well, Tom, that's another good question. And fair is a phrase I want to sort of avoid here. Let me describe it in more practical terms, okay? The concept of progressive taxation, that the higher the rate of income you have, the higher the rate of tax you pay, is arguably the oldest and therefore most conservative principle in Western civilization. It is older than the much-discussed current idea that marriage should be between a man and a woman. If you read the New Testament on what Jesus said about the widow whose husband died and they had no children, that she should marry her brother even though he was married, you'll see that it's older than that because it's 2,500 years old. In ancient Athens, which was paradise on earth compared to everywhere else, everyone paid the same tax. Not the same tax rate, but the same tax, a flat amount. And for 80% of Athenians, this was a terrible burden. It led to all sorts of social problems, as you can imagine, because they enforced the tax by throwing you out into a Hobbesian world where life was nasty, brutish, and short. Well, after 200 years of debate, they came up with a moral principle. There is no gain. There is no wealth without civilization. Therefore, the greater the wealth you are able to achieve because of Athens, that is, because of civilized government, the greater the share you are morally obligated to pay back so that Athens will endure and others who come along in the future will have the same opportunity that you've had. And when they devised this moral principle, they invented democracy. Democracy is the result of the development of the moral principle behind progressive taxation, a principle that has been endorsed by Plato, Aristotle, Adam Smith, the father of modern market economics, John Locke, the libertarian who never met a tax he liked, David Ricardo, every classic worldly philosopher. In fact, George W. Bush, the White House told me, repeatedly believes in the moral principle of progressive taxation. The reason the tax code is complicated has nothing to do with rates. In fact, the author of the book, The Flat Tax, Robert Hall, an eminent economist, originally his idea was to have progressive rates because they add almost nothing in complexity to the tax code. It's a little table. That's all it does. What makes the tax code complex are all the provisions that Congress has put in that allow people and corporations to not pay taxes today. The concept is called recognition of income or realization of income. And if you're allowed to collect a dollar today but say, not have to report it as taxable income, then you get a benefit. And that's what the massive expansion of the tax code is all about. It has nothing to do with graduated rates, which add essentially almost no complexity to the tax code whatsoever.
Another thing that you write about here is the fact that there are utility companies that collect taxes from ratepayers without actually paying those taxes to the federal government.
Yeah, and in Texas, utilities are something people should really be concerned about. There's, in my book, Free Lunch, there are three chapters about what went on here in electricity regulation and taxes, where basically the utility companies got the government to rig the market and create markets that artificially raise prices to the highest possible level. And there's abundant research and data showing this. But in the area of taxes, we talked earlier about companies keep two sets of books. Well, utility companies sort of keep three. They also have a regulatory set of books. And so each month when you pay your electric bill to TU or Reliant or whoever is your electricity provider in Texas, you have to pay all of the company's costs because it is a legal monopoly and has no other way to get money. There's a joke in the industry that one way to raise profits is to redecorate the chief executive's office because they get a guaranteed profit on the expense that they made. So the company collects from you, between, depending on the utility, between 3 and 5% of your monthly electric bill is their state and federal tax burden. They often are able to defer actually turning that money over for 20 years. And the regulatory system, as a result of stuff I and others wrote about in the 1960s and 70s, fixed this system so that ratepayers are now benefit from this. It's no longer an interest-free loan to the company. The amount of that loan is counted as not being part of the company's capital. On the other side, nothing was done about the government. So the utility company collects a dollar today, and it pays the same dollar 20 years later when that dollar's worth maybe 50 cents on the dollar, 60 cents on the dollar. Well, one of the things I have been able to prove from the record is that many of these companies have now figured out ways to legally never turn the dollar over. And when I first exposed this on the front page of the New York Times, I think it was almost 3 years ago, I knew there would be obligatory letters from the industry, and I was waiting to see if they would attack my methodology. They didn't. They simply said, what your story fails to give enough attention to is that we are following the law. We are simply doing what the law allows. And that's exactly right. The law allows utility companies, if they organize themselves correctly and set things up right, to collect dollars from you for taxes they never give the government. That means you pay twice. You pay the company the tax the government never gets, and then you have to make up that tax either through less government services, higher taxes, or more borrowing by government, which is a tax on you forever.
David K. Johnston is my guest. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner and author of a book called Free Lunch. We're talking today about his article in the January-February 2009 issue of Mother Jones Magazine. It's called Fiscal Therapy. You can join us after the break by sending an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Pulitzer Prize-winning tax writer David K. Johnston is my guest. He's got a piece in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. His most recent book is called Free Lunch. We have an email here from Joe in Dallas who says, could a universal sales tax take care of all these loopholes and disparities? What do you think, David?
Say it again.
A universal sales tax.
Well, yes, there's a lot of people who like this idea of a fair tax, which comes, by the way, not from somebody who's a tax authority, but from a radio talk show host. Not to put you down, Chris, I also am the host of a radio talk show on public television in the community where I live.
We all run the gamut, don't we?
But he's not a tax expert at all. And here's what would happen. There are a number of problems with this plan. It doesn't mean you can't have a consumption tax. You can. But a national retail sales tax. First of all, the advocates say, well, you know, everybody would pay because it would be paid on everything you buy. No, trust me, wealthy people will muck up a retail sales tax code the same way they have the income tax. I remember when Donald Trump had his big yacht, he had it registered in Bermuda just so he could avoid the New Jersey state sales tax on his yacht. Secondly, it is inherently regressive. Even if you put in a provision to make sure that all Americans aren't taxed on some level of their income and a check is written to you by the government, you still end up with a situation in which the vast majority of very wealthy people don't consume a large portion of their income. They can't. You can't consume $100 million annual income. You can only reinvest most of it. All the fine bottles of wine, all the fancy dresses, that's not going to consume that size income. Gambling will consume it. That's the one area you probably could blow it all. Next is a problem of privacy. Right now, we have people who furtively slip into buildings to buy drugs. You create a national retail sales tax, and people will be furtively slipping into buildings to buy diamond rings and mink coats and other luxury goods. And the government undoubtedly will then determine that the only way it can fairly enforce this tax is by eliminating cash. We'd have to go to a completely digital money economy where you have a card for every purchase you make. Now, that purchase would mean that there would be a perfect record of every place you've been, every dollar you've spent. Would you like the government or your business partner or your spouse or somebody in litigation with you to have a perfect record of everywhere you've been, when you were there, and what you spent? Talk about loss of privacy. Now, if you want to have a national consumption tax, the way you do it is the way the Europeans have done it, and that's you have a national value-added tax. The mining company that takes iron ore out of the ground has a tax on the value it adds by turning those rocks into iron ore. They sell it to a steel company and pass the tax forward. The steel company adds more to the tax and passes it to the car maker, and you buy the car, and the tax is built into the price of the car you build, and it's a virtuous self-reinforcing tax. And when you export a good, you remove the tax so that you don't damage your economy, which is one of the things the Europeans are doing, the Japanese are doing, the Australians, the Koreans, who are crushing us in some areas of economic competition like automobile making because of their tax and their healthcare systems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Andrew in Frisco. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. How's it going today, Chris?
Great. Thanks.
Dr. Johnston, or Mr. Johnston, I actually just wanted to ask you, essentially, we have this these TARP funds, $350 billion that have been released to bail out bankers and car builders. And essentially, you know, the whole reason we're in this situation is because these bankers have, you know, they have these toxic loans that have just destroyed our economy. And so now we're doing this economic stimulus package that's coming up pretty soon if Barack Obama can get it passed. Well, I was curious, what would happen if instead of using that money to go towards any sort of big businesses or corporations, what if the federal government decided to take that money and turn it around and give it to the taxpayers? Would that have any effect on our economy? And,
okay.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, you know, I'm one of the first people in the country, maybe the first well-known person who went after the TARP plan as a lousy plan. According to the calculations of Bloomberg News, the total value of the bailout so far is $8.4 trillion, not $350 billion. That's all the income taxes all Americans have paid since George Bush took office, plus another $1 trillion. And we may get some of that back, but that's the amount we're on the hook for. We could have bought all the subprime mortgages in America for $500 billion. They're all not going to go bad. Certainly $350 billion would have been enough for the government to just buy all the subprime mortgages, and we would have probably come out close to even. We are now facing $1 trillion of what are called liar's loans, or Alt-A mortgages, the greatest number of which will reset next year in 2010 and cause another big drop in the value of housing if nothing is done. If you just write checks to people, they tend to save the money. That doesn't stimulate the economy. The quickest way the government could get stimulus going in the economy would be to raise by 30-50% the amount of money paid to people who are out of work, the unemployed. We have very modest unemployment benefits. You get out of work in Europe and Japan, you generally get 70-90% of your income restored, particularly when there are no jobs to be had. When it's cyclical, it's not your fault. And that's largely what's happening now. This is a business cycle. So if we wanted to stimulate the economy, if you increase unemployment checks to people and extend unemployment, what will happen is those people are going to spend the money, every cent of it, and that will help enormously.
People in this country would say, well, if you do that, people are never going to go back to work. What's your response?
Well, I don't think anybody's going to try and live on $170 a week or so, particularly when it does run out. I mean, that assumes then the exact opposite of what all our politicians say. What did John McCain say in the election? What did Obama say? America is the most productive workers around. And I've spent a lot of time studying and researching in Europe, and they got a problem there with people who their attitude is, you know, 5 o'clock, I want to go home. I'm going. I don't have to work. I don't want to work. That's a real problem. We don't have that problem. We certainly could create it, but in the short run, we're not saving any money here because people who are out of work through no fault of their own, what do? They lose their homes. They default on debts. They turn to the government for other kinds of services. They don't get an education which makes them more valuable in the future and will make them stronger taxpayers. We should be looking at trying to create a system that creates the greatest possible number of taxpayers and the smallest possible number of tax eaters.
Let's talk about education for a minute. We know that the cost of one's first college education or professional education is rising all the time, not to mention all these millions of people who find themselves in a position of perhaps having to retrain for an entirely new career.
Well, retraining is sort of a chimera for people over the age of 40. you're not going to, as Pat Buchanan used to say, you're not going to turn a 50-year-old steel worker into a computer programmer.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've done with higher education is we used to regard higher education as an investment in the future. We used to think that the gray matter between the ears of young people that could be turned into a rigorous learning machine was the most valuable asset we had in America, and so college was free. I'm the son of a 100% disabled veteran of World War II, and you can imagine the wonderful economic circumstances I therefore grew up under. But I got a college education because public college was free. College today is an $85 billion a year lending industry. Commercial banks overall, over a long period of time, make a 17% return on their equity. But Sallie Mae, the biggest lender in student lending, makes a 51% annual return on average, three times the return of commercial banks. And it makes it because government has set up rules that exempt them from the forces of market competition, exempt them from the risks of banking, and enable them to charge prices as if they were involved in commercial banking and to raise prices. In some cases, students who sign loans that they think are going to pay back at 6 or 7% interest turn into 20% interest loans.
So essentially, the only way to fix this is to start with Sallie Mae.
Well, I think what we need to start with is changing our attitude. We need to stop thinking as if, you know, the world is coming to an end and everything is about us today. We should be thinking about America and its freedoms enduring. And we should be, therefore, recognizing in a world of competition where in science and math, we are in engineering far behind the rest of the world, where we've lost, because of this stem cell research stuff, a big part of our best scientific minds. I know a top researcher who went to China because he couldn't get funded in the United States. And the Chinese communists said, hey, whatever you want, name the amount of money. We'll produce the lab, the research. They gave him everything he wants and the fortunes that are going to grow out of the very, very intriguing and productive work he was doing. They're going to go to China because we didn't fund them. We need to invest in the future. We need to invest in education if we want to endure and compete.
We have an email from Bob in Dallas who says, we've been lowering corporate tax rates over the years, and the reason given is that other countries have lower rates, so we must lower ours to stay competitive. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes and no. I mean, it does matter what other countries charge as rates, although I remind you of the words of O'Neill, the first Treasury Secretary for George Bush, who used to run Alcoa. I never made a decision, and I don't know any competent businessman who ever made a decision based on tax rates. One of the things I think we should be debating is whether we should eliminate the corporate income tax. I think at the end of the day, the debate would show that, no, we don't want to eliminate it, but we certainly could debate doing that, and I think it would lead to a very good discussion about what we do and about all the rules that encourage game playing. We don't want to have a system that encourages game playing, and that's what we have now, that encourages moving jobs offshore, capital offshore, to avoid taxes and hiding money offshore. And that's what our system does now.
We have time for a quick last call that comes from Austin in Dallas. Hi, Austin.
Hi. I have a question, and it's don't you think 90% of these problems would be solved if there was some change in disparity of income through which, you know, the average worker for Nike would have to work for 5,000 years just to make, you know, the CEO's annual bonus, like, and you're making millions versus the bottom level making $5 an hour. Like, if that was fixed, wouldn't most of these taxation problems not matter?
Well, Austin, I think you've hit upon what is actually the Uber issue. And in my books, Perfectly Legal, which came out 5 years ago and won the Investigative Book of the Year Award, and Free Lunch, which is now out in paperback, and somewhat in the article in Mother Jones this month, I talk about this. What we have had is an economy in Reaganism promoting supply side. What we need is demand side. And we need to align pay. I have exposed many of the top pay deals in this country and shown that it's a rigged market. The people in the market say it's a rigged market. It's not paying market returns. It's paying excess returns to CEOs. And a lot of that money is coming by eliminating benefits like health care and pension plans for lower paid workers, squeezing down their wages, getting people to work off the books. It's not an honest system. And we need to go back to having an honest system. We need to focus on higher wages and rewarding people for their marginal contribution to society instead of trying to figure out how to treat them as a cost. There's an old saying in business, properly priced labor is free, because if you pay workers exactly what they're worth, they don't cost you anything. If you pay them too little, then you don't get good workers, and they're very expensive. And if you pay them too much, you're wasting resources. Well, we're paying too little to the vast majority of workers and too much to the CEOs.
Have you come to any understanding, David, as to why there is so little protest, so little outrage over the basic inequities of the way things are set up right now?
Well, sure. I mean, I think the two most important numbers in the United States are 1980 and 37. 37 is the median age of all Americans. Half of all Americans are under 37. And 1980 is the year that Reaganism began. So if you're 37, and in fact I make a pretty good case if you're 47 or under, all you've ever heard are the false economics of Reaganism. We now have 28 years of evidence that they don't work. But when politicians in both parties embrace these ideas, and when they turn tax rate cuts into a secular religion, and they do not understand and have not deeply studied the economics of this stuff, then you have people who misunderstand that. And when you turn on the radio and the TV, you hear the same message all the time. I was on one of the national cable shows one day and made a point which is incredibly thoroughly documented in the government record, and I could hear over the little thing in my ear in the background the producer saying, get him off the air now. Keep that message off the air. Don't let it get out there. That's been a fundamental element. We need to have a serious debate about our economic policies. And I think that will lead us to smarter choices and make our democracy endure.
Pulitzer Prize winner David K. Johnston, that's K-C-A-Y, is a columnist for the trade journal Tax Notes and former tax reporter for the New York Times. His current article in Mother Jones is called Fiscal Therapy. David, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.